Thank you so much. It is really an honor to be here and to see some of my favorite criminologists who I haven't seen for a while. You're among them. So I'm going to basically spin off of my presidential speech. And for those of you who haven't read it, didn't see it, I'll just do a little brief recap. And then I'm going to go in particular about it, focusing in particular about research that relates to this newest phenomenon of a gender responsive approach to women offenders, and in particular women in prison. So in my 2015 ASC speech, I focused on what I considered to be some of the most salient current assumptions underlying research on gender and crime: the generalizability of our ideological theories, the role of women's victimization in their pathways to offending, the role of the acts of their violence, and the often cited plights that characterize women prisoners. Based on the extant research, I tried to show how these assumptions reify the doing gender paradigm, or the notion that the behavior of men and women is framed by the expectation that they'll respond in any given situation in the appropriate masculine or feminine way. I argued this approach ignores the variations in women's histories and the situated actions that can reduce the importance of gender in some contexts, and more importantly, hinders our ability to focus on the context where gender does matter, where scholars and policymakers should direct their energies. So today I want to expand on this perspective by considering a broader array of research that has contributed to my contextualization of gender and crime. More specifically, I want to build on, let's see if this works. Yeah. I want to build on two interrelated arguments from my ASC speech. Arguments that were developed primarily from and consolidated with studies conducted in the US. This, of course, raises the question of how transferable these arguments are, or whether I'm just prattling on and doing nothing more than reinforcing a notion of US criminological exceptionalism. To counter this argument, I'm going to supplement some of my initial findings with research I have conducted in England and the Netherlands. And I'll conclude by offering some suggestions about what I consider to be particularly fruitful directions for future research and policy. Now, first with regard, and this is just the recap, just to set the stage for those who didn't read or know about the speech. With regard to female victimization, I argued the most common paradigms have overstepped the role of victimization in women's pathways to offending. This is commonly referred to as blurred boundaries, and simultaneously stifled evidence that indicates women do commit acts of violence outside of the context of self-defense or victimization. The evidence I marshaled for the first point, the question about women's pathways to offending and the role of victimization, came from a careful review of the pathways literature. This literature draws heavily on female offenders, samples of only female offenders. But if we examine studies that include both men and women, both male and female offenders, we find that abuse is an important risk marker for both. In fact, based on Kathy Whittem's prospective longitudinal data of abused and neglected children, it would appear that abuse is a much stronger risk factor for violent offending among males than females. Some would argue that this misses the considerable evidence that girls are more likely to be sexually abused than boys. But I think the jury's out on this. Number one, males are asked about this much less frequently than females. And when they are, there's evidence that they're more likely to underreport. As such, I think there's ample evidence to suggest that the blurred boundary between victimization and offending isn't gender specific. But what may be gender specific is a type of state dependence between abuse and offending. And I think this has been shown both in the quantitative and the qualitative research. In the quantitative research, it's been shown where people have looked at the mediators of that relationship, and it varies when gender is a moderator. And in the qualitative research, it's been pointed out how abusive experiences can generate oft-timed or precocious life transitions, like early independent living or associating with antisocial males, that then fosters participation in criminal behavior. As I also noted in my presidential speech, the pathways approach has extremely long arms, stretching back to the mid-19th century when women prison reformers described female inmates as victims of child neglect and sexual victimization. And after the eugenics movement, of course, women's mental health problems were added to the prison system's list of female offenders' woes. This characterization of women offenders has remained central to the prison system's structure for dealing with female inmates for the past 175 years. And today, I think it's been repackaged in the guise of a gender-responsive strategy for female offenders. Feminists and policymakers in the US and in England have embraced a gender-responsive approach in corrections. The idea here is that we need to create an environment that reflects an understanding of the reality of women's lives and women's issues. The critical dimension involved in understanding the reality of women's lives are based on the pathways literature. It invokes risk markers thought to be unique to women offenders: victimization, mental health problems, and substance abuse. Interest in this approach has generated the development of gender-responsive assessment tools in lieu of what's been considered the gold standard assessment tool, the Level of Service Inventory Revised. Feminists critical of the LSIR on women offenders point out that it homogenizes women by ignoring the different needs of racial minorities and sometimes conflates needs and risks. Others suggest that it only works for women whose offending profiles are comparable to men's. And still others maintain that while there's evidence that the LSIR is gender neutral, tests of its effectiveness have generally been of poor quality. As a result of these criticisms, gender-responsive assessment tools and interventions, including cognitive behavioral programs, have become increasingly popular. But the extant evidence about the effectiveness of risk tools designed to predict which women will misbehave while they're in prison or recidivate upon release is mixed. Some have maintained these are useful tools relative to gender neutral or standard assessment tools. Others have shown that the relative importance of different risk factors varies across different areas of the criminal justice system. So a history of child abuse and mental health problems may predict that you are not going to adjust well in prison. But these factors have little to do with how women do once they're released from prison, when finances and housing become more important. Evaluations of gender-responsive interventions and cognitive behavioral programs in prison also provide mixed results, with some scholars finding that cognitive behavioral programs are effective regardless of gender and regardless of whether they're supplemented by a gender-specific program. Others maintain a gender-specific program is effective, and especially when they're implemented with fidelity. A really good example of this was recently published in Criminology and Public Policy, 2016. It was a study of moving on a cognitive behavioral gender-responsive program for women inmates. The program focused on improving communication skills, expressing emotions in a healthy way, and generally building healthy relationships. The program was assessed in the state of Minnesota at two time periods. In the first time period, time one, it was given to, with fidelity, program administered perfectly according to Hoyle, to a group of women who volunteered for the program. Time two, they watered the program down because it was now mandatory for all inmates to participate in the program. Although women who participated at time one had lower recidivism rates measured by rearrest and reconviction relative to participants at time two, one wonders if this reduction in recidivism was due to their voluntary participation rather than program integrity. Now, if we move away from research in the US and consider the very foundation of the gender responsive paradigm, it goes back to the pathways literature and the fundamental assumption that men and women have different experiences that lead them to prison. A recent analysis we conducted of Dutch inmates points in exactly the opposite direction. So there are two studies. The first study, the Prison Project by Anja Dertzfager and Paul Nuberta, began in 2010. They surveyed all males between the ages of 18 and 65 who were born in the Netherlands and currently in one of the 32 pretrial detention facilities. Myself and Katrine Beifeld wrote an NWO grant designed specifically to look at this issue of pathways to prison. We piggybacked on their study. Theirs is a longitudinal perspective. Ours wasn't. It was done at one point in time, but it was a retrospective. So we used the first wave of data from the Prison Project and also used some of the same measures so that we could compare across these two studies. We surveyed all of the women who were incarcerated in the Netherlands. At that point in time, it was 636. We had 512 who agreed to participate, but we ended up actually only interviewing 397 because by the time we got to some women, they'd already been released from prison. On average, you can see the women were slightly older than the men. And the female sample also includes a substantial number of women born outside of the Netherlands, about 25%, because we didn't sample on natural born citizenship. Now, the gendered pathways analysis used a total of 16 variables that cover a number of critical life domains and offending history. Did they onset offending before or after the age of 18, type of offense, caregiver situation in childhood, work, income, living situation at the time of arrest, did they have a partner, did they have substance abuse problems, were they a parent? We used latent class analysis for this because we wanted to see how many pathways men had, how many pathways women had, and more importantly, the content of those pathways. Were they similar or different? We found substantial gender overlap in the pathways to prison. I'm going to summarize this for you because you'll be here a long time reading it otherwise. Men and women had four comparable types of pathways. Multi-problem property offenders, multi-problem violent offenders, drug-connected offenders, and low-risk offenders. Further, within three of these offender typologies, the experiences of men and women were comparable. For example, with regard to multi-problem property offenders, both men and women in this group had long-term substance abuse problems, both had mental health problems, unemployment, and substantial debts. Similarly, for the multi-problem violent offenders, both men and women were exposed to parental deviance, and by that we meant their parents had a history of substance abuse problem and offending. Both started offending before the age of 18. Both had a long history of drug use and debts. The drug-connected offenders, regardless of sex, had the highest probability of having children, being involved in a relationship, and acquiring debts prior to imprisonment. The only noticeable difference really was the low-risk offenders. For men, they clustered in two separate categories based on the offense type. For women, they didn't. They were just low-risk offenders. And that may be a result of having a smaller sample size for the women. But generally, these findings suggest that interventions don't necessarily need to be tailored to the specific needs of women, as mental health and substance abuse problems characterize both male and female multi-problem property and violent offenders. Unfortunately, we didn't have comparable measures of victimization. We asked about it, but Anya and Paul didn't. But in another analysis we conducted that focused on women's age at onset of offending and whether that differentiates their pathways to prison, we found a history of child physical or sexual abuse had no direct effect on risk of incarceration, regardless of age at onset, once dynamic adult experiences were taken into account. And these findings are also consistent with Knighton's and Christen's qualitative analysis of women prisoners in Belgium. And it underscores the import of women's adult relative to their childhood experiences. Clearly, this supports the assumption that if abuse, child abuse, is related to women's offending, it's likely a product of state dependence rather than a direct causal link. More generally, our findings suggest that what may differentiate male and female offenders' trajectories to prison is their relationships and their debts. These two factors affected all of women's trajectories, but only three of the five male pathways. Now, we didn't have comparable information on the nature of men and women's relationships, but we do know from the extant research that for women, partnering with an antisocial male significantly increases their odds of committing a crime. This is an area where it's really hard to think about how you would design an intervention. Women's criminality is more heavily stigmatized than men's, and their pool of relative partners is more limited. However, I think the strong association between debts and all types of female offending warrants intervention. There was a group of Finnish scholars, this was just published in Criminology in 2016, Altonen, Oskansen, and Kavori, I hope I'm saying that correctly. They did an extensive exploration of the relationship between debts and crime using a Finnish general population sample with an 8-year follow-up. And they found that the odds of committing any crime are 3.6 times higher if you have a debt than if you don't. And that association remains significant even when controls for socioeconomic status were included in the analysis. Based on their debt trajectories, they also suggest that debt problems worsen over time because you get out of prison or you get a crime, you've got an unpaid fine, you can't pay the fine, you commit another crime, et cetera, et cetera. In essence, it seems to be a product of reciprocal causation. And I think it's likely that this is a problem that's particularly acute for women offenders when they're exiting prison and trying to reestablish their lives. So I think this suggests that the use of criminal fines should be significantly reduced, and teaching women how to manage their finances and credit histories could have an impact on their probability of reoffending. If women and men's pathways into prison are largely similar, are their lives also similar after they're released from prison? I think in many ways they are. They have to grapple with finding a job, reuniting with their families, oftentimes maintaining a drug-free lifestyle. The gender-responsive approach has focused on wraparound services that are conceived of as being an extension of the kinds of programs women were exposed to while they were in prison. The Corsten report addressed this in recommending, and I quote, a seamless continuation of care and provision both inside and outside the prison walls, and in highlighting the work of the women's community services. The import of the women's community services for women when they're released from prison was further underscored in a successor to the Corsten report, a distinct approach, a guide to working with women offenders, which was published by the Ministry of Justice in 2012. Now, some have suggested that the programs developed under the guise of gender responsiveness do little more than reinforce gender stereotypes because they focus on intimate relationships, or as the Moving On program did in Minnesota, healthy communication, intimate relationships, and parenting in lieu of vocational training. But prison-based programs for substance abuse do appear to lower women's recidivism rates. And relatively speaking, however, these programs touch the lives of very, very few prisoners. In the United States, only 11% of all inmates have any exposure to an alcohol or drug treatment program while they're incarcerated. And the last data I could find available for England suggested that the number of women starting and completing a substance abuse program fell by 89% between 2014 and 2015. Given the importance of these programs, what do we know about their effectiveness when they're part of a wraparound service? Grella and Rodriguez surveyed about 1,200 women in California who were part of a in-prison substance abuse program that followed them when they were on parole in aftercare. And they found that the women who participated did have lower recidivism rates than the control group. But program participation wasn't based on random assignment. So it's unclear whether these findings are due to selection effects. I only know of one study that systematically examined whether a gender-responsive program for women on probation and parole lowers the rates of recidivism. This was conducted by Mary Marash in Michigan, and she focused specifically on drug-abusing women. Some of the women were assigned to a gender-responsive parole unit or probation unit. She had both. And some were just given the standard probation and parole care. She had no findings. There was no difference whatsoever in the recidivism rates of these two women. She ascribes the no findings to the fact that she thinks the women in the gender-responsive probation parole situations were more carefully scrutinized than the other women. Now, because so much of the discussion about women prisoners focuses on their pre-prison lives and how this influences their risk of misbehaving in prison or recidivating upon release, what happens and what they experience while they're incarcerated has been somewhat left on the sidelines. Now, of course, concern has been voiced about how correctional officers need to be cognizant of the traumas women have experienced. And they also need to know that women are going to respond differently than men to the carceral environment. But adequate adjustment to prison rests not only on what experiences women bring to prison with them, but also on what they experience once they're institutionalized. Now, I realize that there are people in this room who have done a ton of work on the importance of what goes on within the institution, right, and how correctional officers and inmates interact. But in the US, this has been on the sidelines. Since the heyday of prison sociology, people haven't been so concerned with the question of how do you do time and how does the prison environment influence that. We conducted a study at NSCR, and this used, this is a couple years old, but I think it's relevant. This used several different data sources, but the fun part is it looks at it across different penal contexts. So the data from California were based on the data Rosemary Gartner and I collected in two women's prisoners there. Then I came over for a sabbatical here in England, and Allison was very generous in helping me get into three women's prisons here. And so I took the surveys I had conducted in California and administered them here. And then Anne-Marie Slotbaum at NSRC had data that was gathered in four women's prisons in the Netherlands. So this would be a fun comparison about what's it like to do time in these different contexts. And I need to briefly set the stage here in terms of some of the differences. So penal policy in California, it has really been paradigmatic of Garland's notion that we've moved from penal welfareism to a culture of control. And as Garland and others showed, to a certain extent, England followed this pathway. They increased their incarceration rate, but nothing like the United States or California, right? And so one of the defining features of imprisonment for women in California was overcrowding. And interestingly, if anyone wants to talk about this afterwards, after realignment, that's when California was on court order to reduce the size of their prison population. So the notion is they were going to shift the population down into county jails. The low-risk offenders, the non-serious, non-violent, non-sex offenders, were all going to go out. Now, the biggest non-population there is female offenders. But what's really interesting is they closed one of the mammoth prisons. One of the ones we did had, that this survey data is based on, had 8 women to a cell. They closed one of those, but what happened is the other two now ballooned into two. One holds 3,000 and the other holds 2,000. And then a small group of women went to an adjunct in Folsom Prison. But at any rate, that's a long way of saying California has extreme overcrowding, and that hasn't changed since we conducted this. As a result of that, though, there was a tremendous amount of emphasis in the prison system on women getting out of their cells, working, programming, education, just get out of your cell. But no attempts to prepare women for housing or employment issues they'd face upon release. In the 3 English prisons I studied, conditions of confinement were clearly more benign, clearly less crowded. But there was also less emphasis placed on engaging in work or education programs, or more generally spending time outside your cell. They also, this unlike California, they took the notion of creating a gender responsive environment for women seriously. And the government's response was to produce a number of gender-specific standards in Prison Order 4800. And these primarily related to making their cells a more home-like environment with toiletries and cosmetics and some group activities. The Netherlands, at the time this study was conducted, had also shifted to a crime control model. They put in place a number of anti-crime measures between 1990 and 2002. And the result of those, I know their population's declined now, but the result of those at that time was their prison population increased dramatically for them, minor league for us, but it increased dramatically for them, so much so that they started considering abandoning their one person to one cell policy. But this did not, even though there was more crowding at the time our survey was conducted, it didn't result in women spending more time outside of their cells because there was a lack of staff. Gender responsive regimes were unheard of in the Netherlands, but women with sentences or 4 months or longer could participate in a reducing recidivism program so that in the last 3 months of their sentence, they could spend 60 hours out in the community looking for a job and reuniting with their families. So, 3 different penal contexts, but we have the same set of questions. So our independent variables included a number of demographic factors, and note in particular prior mental health and prior drug use was included in this. And we also included data on their criminal justice experiences and their current carceral experiences, how much interaction they had with other inmates and correctional staff. The dependent variable, perceived control over your day-to-day life. The importance of perceived control over your surroundings is well recognized in the social and behavioral sciences literature. And we know that an absence of a sense of control is associated with a lot of measures of psychological distress. This is especially true, as many of you know, in the prison environment, because it's been shown to be one of the most important determinants of prisoners' behavior and psychological well-being. These are some descriptive statistics, and I'll just highlight a few things here that are interesting. I think clearly the women in the Netherlands are the most independent relative to women in either California or England. They were most likely to be employed at the time of arrest. They were more likely to have not been married and less likely to have had a young child. In terms of criminal justice experience, English women show up as having more jail or prison sentences, but look at the variable number of months on current offense. I think because sentences are so long in California, that these women have less street time to accumulate prior offenses. Women in California are significantly more likely to be involved in a prison program, but their interactions with correctional officers are decidedly worse than women's experiences in England or the Netherlands. Now, finally, let's take a look at results from a logistic regression. And I only printed the significant coefficients here. So of all the variables we looked at, this is what came out. In the total sample, Netherlands is the reference category. So the big picture here suggests that relative to demographic and background experiences, it's the immediate interactions women have with staff and the connections they establish with other prisoners that shape their sense of control. A focus on gender-responsive programming implies the unique histories of women, their addictions, their mental health problems are central to their adjustment. But neither of these factors appear to be important in any of these three contexts. Context is important, however. Women in prison in California ironically feel more control over their day-to-day lives than either the women in Netherlands or England. Relatively speaking, they have much longer sentences to cope with, but what they do have is productive time outside of their cells. Women are motivated to get out of their cells, not just because they're crowded, but also because the Department of California Corrections and Rehabilitation's regulations allows them to accrue good time credits for spending time programming, right? So you can sleep in your cell all day if you want, but if you want any time off your sentence, you're probably gonna get out there and join with some others in programs. One prisoner in California who was doing time for a probation violation she incurred as a result of testing positive for drugs said, "I hate to be in my room. That's why I started programming. I can't sit here and lay down. I have to do something." And then she starts going through all the different activities she can access there. She says it's something to do. It's not just sitting here in prison doing nothing. You don't have to sit up here and be locked in your cell. An English prisoner who had been that I interviewed, who had been in four different prisons before Edmund Hills, told me the best prison she was in was a working prison because you can use your time rather than sitting in your cell and waiting for the door to be opened. Or, as a prisoner at Downsview said, you spend a lot of time thinking, watching TV, doing your courses. She said she could do exercises, but her wrists are bothering her, so she's not doing those. And then she said, "I can write letters, I can rearrange my room, but I'm not allowed to do that anymore." In the Netherlands, women also described a similar dismal routine that prevented relatively little control over their daily lives. As one woman said, increasing number of women, decreasing number of staff, sometimes you're locked in your cell the whole day and you have more stress. And another describes filling her time primarily with TV and occasionally sports, but she says, "Actually, I don't do much. Lay in our chairs, eat, sleep, lay in our chairs." Now, I think the importance of spending productive time outside of your cell is underscored by another analysis I did with Mike Volo. And this came from when I finished doing the interviews in England. I was struck by the amount of self-harm I saw among these women. Their arms were cut. And I didn't see that in California. Did I miss it? So you get out the data, right? And I had questions on this in both countries. And it was true. I found that overall self-harm and suicide ideation was 4 times higher in England than it was in California. But when we started to do this analysis, there was absolutely no difference in the factors that predicted this phenomenon. As Allison knows this, youthfulness, prior self-harm, and a history of mental health problems, findings which aren't particularly new. But what may be new was our consideration of how different penal regimes interact with individual factors in affecting self-harm and suicide ideation. The interaction effects we explored, I think, show this well. Feeling close to a correctional officer increased the risk of self-harm and suicide ideation only in England. Now, I know Her Majesty's Prison Service dedicated a lot of resources to this problem, and that could generate feelings of closeness to correctional officers who are implemented with putting forth programs such as assessment, care and custody, and teamwork. But it could also be that these women are the ones who feel most isolated in prison and have no other interpersonal connections other than with correctional officers. And I think the latter may be the more accurate interpretation based on 2 other interactions. First, in England only, women with prior teen commitments had reduced odds of suicide ideation. And perhaps this is because, as one woman described to me, they're one of the season ticket holders. That is, the women who come in and go out and come in and go out and come in and go out. So they know how to do time quite well. Second, we also found that only in England were the women who were homeless or who lived alone prior to incarceration more likely to self-harm. And I think if the prison experience compounded their prior feelings of isolation, this could explain the disparity. One older English prisoner who was particularly disturbed by the amount of time she spent locked in her cell felt she was going to be a different person and perhaps not a better one. She talks about being locked up all day and only getting out at dinner time. Maybe this has changed since that period of time. She talks about being the older, one of the older prisoners and how this must affect the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And she also talks about that this generates a lot of time to think, and she's quite, I don't want to say moody, but she's not a happy camper when the correctional officers come in the morning, right? But she says you've got all night to think about these things. They just take people and lock them up. I think all of this suggests that we need to be just as attuned to the interaction and activities that foster a sense of well-being in the carceral context as we are about addressing women's needs based on their pre-prison experience. With this in mind, I also think it's important to note that women often report the worst aspect of doing time is being separated from their children. And studies have shown that increased visiting by children reduces depressive symptoms, anxiety, and stress. There's also some evidence that this kind of context can reduce recidivism more generally and improve family relations. A really interesting study done by Cochrane in 2014 compared 4 groups of prisoners, all of whom had different lengths of sentences. Prisoners who had visitation when they first started their sentence, but then it trailed off. Prisoners who had continuous visitation the whole time they were incarcerated. prisoners who had visitation only right before they were released, and of course those who had no visitation whatsoever. He found that prisoners visited early or continuously had lower recidivism rates. Further, Moen and Vischer, using a subsample of the returning home data from Houston, Texas, this is a huge study going on in the United States of experiences of prisoners who are reentering, demonstrated that this kind of sustained contact with family members produced significantly better family interactions. So these findings taken together clearly indicate incarcerated women do better when they have contact with their children. And more generally, sustained visitation during imprisonment can reduce recidivism and improve family relations. But how does maternal incarceration affect children? And does visitation mitigate any of the effects? It's long been assumed that maternal incarceration has a negative impact on children. However, more recent work paints a very complicated picture. And I think this has been demonstrated particularly well in a series of articles by Christopher Wildman using the Fragile Families and Child Well-Being data, trying to explain why some studies find maternal incarceration has a negative effect on kids and others don't. They focused on contextual effects. Specifically, they examined the likelihood of maternal incarceration based on a number of factors: the mother's race, percent living below poverty line, education, paternal incarceration, and self-reported depression. They found that middle school children who were least likely to experience maternal incarceration had the worst outcomes, and those outcomes were measured by internalizing or externalizing behavior or early self-reported delinquency. By contrast, the children who had mothers that were most likely to experience maternal incarceration had no negative outcomes. They suggest this latter group is extremely disadvantaged. So the additional detrimental effect of maternal incarceration had no additive effect. Or as Giordano and Cope concluded from Giordano's study of the children of institutionalized delinquents, the parents' broader lifestyle of drug use, violence, and economic disadvantage outsized the effects of maternal incarceration on children. So clearly the answer to the question of whether maternal incarceration negatively affects children isn't easy, yet it's become folk wisdom, or in some cases gendered wisdom, that the effects are always negative. In reality, it depends on the context of the child's life before this event occurs. So we might also think that's going to affect how they respond in the visitation context as well. And the extant research bears that out. Whether children benefit from visiting their mothers in prison depends on the visitation environment, the caregiver's communication with the mother, the child's age, and the child's attachment to the caregiver and the mother. Now, prison personnel can do little to address these interpersonal features that relate to the frequency and quality of time the child had with their mother, but they can devote time and energy to creating a positive, hospitable environment and one that reduces the barriers to visiting. And notably, Sherratt's interviews with 135 families in four European countries suggest this is something the UK does particularly well. Well, women offenders have always been considered a distinct problem for policymakers, and especially the correctional community. Too small to warrant too much attention or too many resources, yet distinct enough to generate a different causal and a restorative approach. However, as the number of women in prison in the U.S. Doubled between 1990 and 2005 and tripled in England between 1993 and 2005, policymakers took note. Now, this rapid rate of increase has declined since that period of time, But today, England still houses 2,000 more women than they did 20 years ago. And the United States houses 83,000 more women than they did 20 years ago. The upshot, I think, has been a search for a quick fix. And in the process, I think what has been overlooked is the importance of the context that puts some women with early life deficits on a pathway to offending and eventually imprisonment. This goes back to my presidential speech where I tried to highlight the importance of understanding when gender matters or when we need a gender-specific approach to a given problem. Women's victimization doesn't always produce subsequent offending. Instead, the extant research suggests that later life events provide the context that determine how this risk factor is played out. Carbone, Lopez, and Miller, I think, illustrated this particularly well in their analysis of the life course of meth users, women who were meth users. Nearly a third of these women reported they had been sexually abused either in childhood or adolescence. Yet they rarely attributed their meth addiction to that experience. Instead, they said the abuse experience pushed them to take on adult roles and responsibilities that paved the way for their meth use. Our own research with Dutch prisoners suggests that both men and women share a number of similar life course adversities. And among the women we interviewed, it was the more proximal rather than distal events that increased their risk for imprisonment. More broadly, I think these kinds of findings reaffirm the importance of examining the relative impact of early risk factors and later life events, a point raised by David Farrington in his treaty on advancing research and desistance. And they should prompt us to question feminists' heavy reliance on women's early traumatic life experiences as being determinative of their future trajectories. Pathways to crime and prison are not strictly linear, they're developmental. If pathway scholars have missed the developmental context that move a traumatic childhood experience into later imprisonment, I think prison policies have been oblivious to it. Gender-responsive risk assessment tools give primacy to early traumatic experiences and mental health in forecasting prison adjustment, but they seem to ignore how the conditions of confinement can affect women's well-being. Further, this women-centered approach is based, I think, on an inherent contradiction that on the one hand seeks to ameliorate gender disparities in correctional policies, and the other hand reinforces them. The immediate context that brought women to prison and often produces recidivism, substance abuse, employment, unemployment, financial difficulties, housing, is downplayed relative to their trauma and mental health problems. Recently highlighted one aspect of this in England with the development of the offender personality disorder pathway for women offenders. This pathway was designed to expand the number of treatment placements in prison for offenders who have a serious personality disorder. The OPD pathway for women, Player tells us, grew out of the women-centered approach in the Corsten report and a concern with gender equity. Because fewer women than men are diagnosed with a social personality disorder, the criteria for the OPD pathway for women had to be broadened. And as Player points out, this has a number of serious consequences. It can expand the period of correctional oversight to which women are subject. It pathologizes their histories and can stigmatize them going forward. And because assessment of progress within the OPD pathway is based on women accepting the fact that they have a serious personality disorder, their own assessment of their ability to make sound judgments is seriously compromised. But of most importance, most aspects of gender-responsive programming, when they're released from prison, the structural contexts that contributed to their confinement left unaddressed will continue to contribute to their reoffending. In closing, I think there's ample evidence that scholars and policymakers subscribe to the notion of doing gender, because the underpinning of most approaches to male and female offenders upholds gender stereotypes. For women, we prioritize trauma and illness. For men, dangerousness. But in both cases, we ignore the contexts that are particularly germane to their lives. Now, this isn't to say that all offenders are similar regardless of their gender. Rather, it's a call to carefully examine the structural contexts that are most proximal causes of offending and recidivism, contexts that aren't determined necessarily by gender alone, but by the ways in which gender can interact with other aspects of social inequality, like race or social class. Blanket assumptions underlying gender-responsive treatments and the effects of maternal imprisonment on children ignore important contextual differences in the lives of offenders and children. Whether these be issues with substance abuse, debts, housing, or unemployment, addressing them with specific programs might turn prison time into at least a facsimile of a useful experience that will have some relevance for helping to rebuild prisoners' lives. Thank you.